Anyone who has read Lewis on the themes of science, power, and progress in books like The Abolition of Man or That Hideous Strength or many of his essays would agree that, were he alive today, Lewis would be commenting about the direction of genetic research, whether it takes the extreme form of imagining the cloning of human beings or the less extreme form of germ cell therapy in the treatment of disease. Current directions in genetic engineering offer unprecedented temptations to assume the power to remake ourselves and coming generations in fundamental ways. But if, as it is commonly assumed, human nature has no objective nature, and if we believe that there should be no boundaries, no limits to how we might retool our biology, by what standards might researchers say no to progressively radical procedures? Jeremy Rifkin's new book, The Biotech Century, is not principally about bioethics, but it sketches out the social and economic changes already underway that will call for more careful ethical and moral reflection. As Rifkin's title suggests, genetic engineering is a defining aspect of our near-term future.
We're not going to be able to ignore the age of biology. The bottom line is, just as the 19th century was the age of physics and the 20th century, to some extent, was the age of chemistry, the 21st century will be the age of biology. We are learning about genes. We're learning about how genes turn on and off, how they express themselves, how they mutate, how they interact with a larger environment. We're learning about the way the blueprints of evolution, how we're learning how biology operates on this planet. Now, the question is not the science. The science is invaluable. The issue is, what kind of technologies will we use to apply our knowledge of the new science? And that's where we're going to have a tremendous debate. And I think we have to back up for a moment and understand the enormity of this shift taking place. This is not just a shift in terms of a few new food crops and some medical therapies and drugs. We're making a wholesale transition out of the Industrial Revolution into the biotech century. Unfortunately, our futurists have done us a disservice, because for 15 years they have been championing the information age and heralding the advent of the information age revolution. I think they have misunderstood and misdefined the dynamics of the 21st century. Calling the 21st century the information age is a little like calling the industrial age the print press age. The computer is not a primary resource. It's a language. It's a form of communication. It's a management tool, and it has a direct analogy with the print press. The print press was the essential form of communication to organize a fast-paced culture based on coal and steam power. Similarly, what's really happening now in the global economy is this. The computer is just a prelude to a far more profound revolution in commerce. Over the last 40 years, computer technologies and genetic technologies have been operating on parallel tracks. The information sciences, the life sciences. They're now fusing together for the first time with the new fields of bioinformatics and genomics. And these two technology revolutions are creating a single revolution. When we look back at the 21st century, we will see that the computer is the language. It's the communication form. It's the management tool to decipher, download, and organize genes. And genes are the raw resource of the coming century, just like metals, fossil fuels, and minerals were the raw resource of the industrial century. So the real shift going on in the global economy, we're moving from fossil fuels, metals, and minerals, the Industrial Revolution, to genetic commerce, the raw resources of the biotech century. The public's not aware that the life science industries are beginning to maneuver to control genetic commerce. In the last 12 months, Monsanto, DuPont, Novartis, and Hirsch Chemical, the four giant petrochemical companies of the industrial age, in the last 12 months, they have made the decision to sell off their entire chemical divisions to concentrate solely on genetic commerce. That is the end of the petrochemical era, the metamorphosis into the age of genes. The industry reports on it, but the public has no idea that's happening. A second thing that's interesting is that the mergers and acquisitions going on now in the life science industries dwarf, in some cases, the mergers and acquisitions going on in telecommunication, entertainment, and software industry. But the public doesn't read about it in the general press, because the public debate is still centering around telecommunications and computers.
Mm-hmm.
And also, the public's not aware of the fact that the real issue here is genes. Whoever owns the genes owns the biotech century. Genes are the raw resource, as precious in the next century as oil was in our century, and minerals and metals.
I imagine that most people don't know that you can patent a gene. They think a gene is something that, like air or some unnatural thing.
Well, it is a natural thing. Unfortunately, our patent office has violated its own mandate. The mandate of the patent office is that you cannot patent discoveries of nature. If in the last century a chemist were to isolate oxygen or helium or gold, they could get a patent on the process they used, but they couldn't patent the isolated product because oxygen, helium, and gold are discoveries of nature. The same is true with the genes. It's exact analogy. Genes are never invented de novo. They're discoveries of nature. They're God's creation. Yet our patent office has wantonly, egregiously violated its own statutes by allowing companies to patent genes, chromosomes, cell lines. Within the next 10 years, virtually all 60,000 genes that make up the blueprint for the human race will be identified because of the Human Genome Project. Virtually every one of those genes will be the intellectual property of a life science company, giving them ownership over the blueprints for the human race. That is unprecedented commercial power to dictate the terms upon which our future evolution as a species depends. And these life science companies are also scouting the planet, looking for rare microorganisms, plants, animals, and humans that have genetic traits that are valuable, and then they're seeking patents on them. This, I think, will interest your listeners. Dr. Wilmot, who cloned the sheep, Dr. Wilmot's company, PPL, has applied for a patent at the U.S. Patent Office that would give his company a process patent on all cloning and would also give him intellectual property control over all patented animals, and there's an addenda. His patent application, PPL, would cover all human cloned embryos as his invention.
Hmm.
Now, regardless of where you stand on right to life pro-choice, I believe both sides would be shocked and aghast to know that there is a patent application at the patent office, and the patent office is going to grant him this patent, allowing him to claim human embryos, cloned embryos, as his invention. Because under the patent guidelines set up by the patent office, you can patent anything but a full human being.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason you can't patent a full human being is that the 13th Amendment of the Constitution forbids slavery. But the patent office said you can patent all the individual parts of a human being, the genes, the chromosomes, the cell lines, the organs, the tissue, and the embryos, because they're not considered a human being till birth.
Mm.
So this is a kind of out-of-control government policy, where the intrinsic value of life and God's creation has been reduced purely to utility that can then be enclosed in commercial hands, giving life science companies a lock over the blueprints of evolution itself. Unfortunately, as we see these new breakthroughs in the genetic technology, there's this new social biology, this new science of nature over nurture that's accompanying and legitimizing this new genetic commerce in redefining our sociology, to say that you are your genes. And therefore, if you want to change society, forget about reforming the institutions and stewarding the environment and trying to remediate the organizations. Instead, you better change the genes, because the genes are the most important factor. That's very dangerous thinking. And it introduces, if you will, a term that's inseparable to this debate. That term is eugenics.
So in some possible scenario, governments could decide that they have a peculiar interest in directing the genetic makeup of their citizens in a particular direction.
Well, let me say this. I don't think it even has to be that dramatic. When we think of eugenics, we think of Nazi Germany,
mm-hmm.
The ultimate attempt to exercise control over the human race by government fiat, and, of course, the eugenics movement and the Holocaust. Is there a new eugenics? Yes. This new science, this new technology is generating a new eugenics. Does it have any resemblance to Nazi Germany? No. No. There's no evil cabal, there's no conspiracy to force us into Brave New World. Quite the contrary. The new eugenics is commercial, it's market-driven, it's banal, and the life science companies are saying to consumers, don't you want to have healthy babies?
Mm-hmm.
Nonetheless, this commercial eugenics could have the same consequences in the long run as social eugenics,
mm-hmm.
and we could end up with the kind of Brave New World Aldous Huxley warned us about even though the enemy may be us, consumers in the marketplace expressing our desires.
So every mom and dad can demand Aryan perfection.
Well, I'll give you an example. First of all, a recent Harris poll, which I cite in the Biotech Century, in the book, suggests that 43% of Americans would already make changes in the genetic makeup of their children in the sperm and the egg to create a better baby. But, you can make a compelling case for this. That's what makes the new eugenics so dangerous and seductive. It's the ultimate Faustian bargain. Within 7 or 8 years from now, prospective parents will be able to come to their doctor and take a genetic test for thousands of genes. Right now, you can be screened for 900. But in the next few years, you'll be able to screen for all of the genes and genetic predispositions. So you will know, you'll have a crystal ball, which will allow you to gaze into your child's biological future before they're even conceived. Now, if you knew you were going to pass on childhood leukemia, wouldn't you want to eliminate that from the sperm and the egg? Or cystic fibrosis, or sickle cell anemia, or Huntington chorea. But then again, where would you ever say no? If you knew your child would be legally blind, or have the obesity gene, or extreme short stature from growth deficiency, or a gene for manic depression, or for dyslexia, why wouldn't you make any of those changes so you could have the healthiest, most emotionally secure baby at birth? Every parent wants the best for their child. On the other hand, once we begin to see our children as the ultimate shopping experience, and we become the architects playing God in designing our own offspring, this is the greatest change in parent-child relationships in history. Who decides what a perfect baby should look like? Should consumers have that preference and that choice in the marketplace? Then again, what happens if a baby is born that is not engineered and that may have some disability or deviate from culturally acceptable norms? Will we see that little boy or girl as a mistake, as an error that should have been eliminated?
Jeremy Rifkin, whose new book is called The Biotech Century, Harnessing the Gene and Remaking the World. If you're interested in an imaginative exploration of the idea of children as the ultimate shopping experience, I recommend you look at the 1997 movie Gattaca, which considers a possible future in which genetic design of babies is routine.
I'll never understand what possessed my mother to put her faith in God's hands rather than those of her local geneticist.
And if the bioethical issues discussed in Jeremy Rifkin's book are something you'd like to examine more closely, let me suggest that you consider studying Gilbert Mylander's book, Bioethics, A Primer for Christians. It was published in 1996 by Erdmans, and it's the first audiobook produced by Mars Hill Audio. The postcard mailed to subscribers with this tape has some ordering information, or you can just call our toll-free number to find out how to order an audio cassette copy of Gilbert Mylander's Bioethics, A Primer for Christians.